The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary. It's hour number two of the Bible Study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. You can join us with questions and comments at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be happy to put you on the radio here. Our guest in this hour of conversation is Dr. Martin Nolan. He is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. How are you?
Formerly the executive director of the Concordia Historical Institute. Used to be just down the road here, but now is serving as the pastor at Trinity in Evansville. How long has it been since you made that change? About a year or so, I guess?
I came here about 2 years ago.
2 years
and I
already
finished my work at the Institute in May of 2008, so that'd actually be 3 years.
That's just hard to believe.
I know, Chuck. You and I are just getting old.
We are getting old. I'd like you to get old a little faster than I do.
Yeah, but I saw you out in the court. I mean, what was it?
That's right.
A couple of months ago, you were...
Did you say, who is that old guy out there on the court?
You were keeping up with the kids. I was impressed, Chuck. I mean, you were running back and forth as fast as they were.
I get a head start. That's the secret.
Well, and that makes the parents happy because you're right there to see the call. You know, some refs, they just kind of sit on the sidelines.
Are you suggesting that there were some parents that were happy with the officials? Are you suggesting that?
They were actually happy with your
officiating
because they had been at other leagues, and they were not happy with some of the referees there. And they said, who is that guy? He's running around and trying to figure out what those calls are. He's good.
That should earn me great favor with the Lord, shouldn't it?
Well, it was somebody. Certainly with the parents.
Maybe
we
not
might
the Lord.
We might be back there next year.
Good. They're looking to add a gymnasium out at Metro East Lutheran High School. A second facility there. And so the folks who run the tournament there are hopeful they'll be able to run two games at a time out at the high school. That'll be great.
Great.
We won't have to do as much driving around. All right, sir. Well, I hate to do this to you since you were not in a position to hear the first hour, but... I kind of made a mistake here. We did 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 through 12, and I got all hung up on verses 1 and 2, spent the first 40 minutes on verses 1 and 2, and then we kind of had to hustle through verses 3 through 12. So if you have your Bible in front of you there.
It's right here.
Oh, good. There is one thing that I would like to ask about here as pertains to 1 Peter chapter 1. And... that is verse 8. Let me just read a little ahead of this. It's really hard to set up context here because it's just sort of a one big thought. But Peter says, "In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Then verse 8 says, "Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory." Now there's something that is sort of taken for granted and increasingly becoming problematic, I think, here in American Christianity. These believers that Peter is writing to, excuse me, are commended because they are believers in spite of the fact that, unlike Peter, they had never actually seen the Lord Jesus Christ. And they are in a position now that they can't go to see him now. But they believe, and because of their faith, they rejoice with joy that is inexpressible. Well, that describes all of us now, Pastor. None of us has ever seen Jesus, and we can't go see him now, and yet we still believe. However, it seems that there are more voices. The atheists, you know, they have risen up, the new atheists have risen up, and there is an ongoing effort to discredit the Bible, whether it's a couple of years ago and and you know, the Epistle of Thomas and things like that, Gnostic Gospels. Now there's a guy who's written a book called Forged, and he's claiming that many of the books that we have in the New Testament were not actually written by the people who bear their name. There seems to be a full-scale onslaught on the quote-unquote evidence of the Bible, so that people who have not seen him still love him, people who do not see him now still rejoice. And those people are maybe feeling the pressure, Pastor. They're being made to feel like fools because they believe in something that they cannot see and have never seen. Have I overstated this, or do you see the issue as I've described it?
Well, I think I understand what you're talking about in terms of the current context.
This particularly is affecting the 20-somethings and 30-somethings.
Yeah. And I would say that it really, there's a period in life where kind of like all holds, what they say, no holds barred. And that is for most people when they enter high school, they begin to question everything. And it's kind of part of what, it's part of growing up, trying to make up your own mind about what you believe and what your values are going to be. So high school, college years, up until the point that you get married and have your first child, this whole period of life is very, you know, and so they're looking, and I think at least in our culture, I can't speak for other cultures like China or India, it is a time for questioning, and that's the time where people that have a different idea, let's say cults, like remember David Koresh down in Waco, Texas, that's the period of life, those are the people he targets, because he knows that they're looking for something new or something different. And it goes the same thing with the atheists and with other people that have different ideas than traditional Christianity. They're going to target that age group. And however they do it, they're going to try to explain it in a way that is most appealing to that particular group. You know, and once you get to the point of raising kids, you're in a different position where you turn around and say, the fourth commandment is not such a bad idea. Children, obey your parents, because if they don't, this world is going to go crazy, in other words, your own home life. And then because that you're in a position of responsibility, you begin to see, oh, there's a lot of things in the Bible that make a whole lot of sense. And as you get older, you know, like you're my age now, Chuck, you begin to sit back and say, well, if I was going to create a world, God did a pretty good job, actually. You know, because the world I'm trying to create around me is, you know, it doesn't always in control, and God made a lot of good choices. So whereas in the younger ages, where you're just trying to cast off any sort of shackles or things that don't appeal to you, in older age you begin to reflect and say, hey, it makes a lot more sense. I don't know if that's always been the case historically, but we got to realize first off that these younger people that don't have responsibilities for children or for managing other people, that these things are attractive to them. Now the question is this these arguments of atheists and the way they distort Christianity, is this new? Well, it's not new. Actually, the time when it really started coming out into the open and affecting the public was the late 17th century. If you can imagine that. I mean, this is the time that America was being settled in colonies. And there was a group of people called the Deists that decided that they were going to attack the Bible and traditional Christianity. Not just the Roman Catholic Church, because the Protestants had done that, but the Bible, and the whole Bible story itself. Miracles, prophecies, the traditional idea that Jesus gave his life as a sacrifice, and that through that the world would be saved. All those things were up for grabs. And the most famous book was by a guy named John Toland. It's like Noland with a T. I believe it was about in the 1690s, and the title was Christianity is Not Mysterious. And what he did was he tried to play reason or reasonable thinking over against the Bible. and said the Bible is a bunch of, a bunch of things that don't make sense at all. They're a bunch of irrationalities. And if you believe it, you're kind of dumb, or, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the first time that really on a large scale. Now, there had been other thinkers, with, they're known as Epicureans, but they never had much of an effect. There wasn't any political support for them. But in the 1690s, when the English middle class was trying to get some headway against the king and the aristocrats, Toland's ideas had a lot of appeal. The American version of this would be Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which came like 80 years later in the colonies, and it had a lot of effect too. And so then what's interesting for historians to watch is, so when Toland's idea came out, I mean, boy, it was like the whole world was going to fall apart because everybody was going to become atheist. And then the defenders of Christianity, Lutherans, Anglicans, Roman Catholics, all came to the defense and pretty much destroyed his arguments, and everybody seemed to become Christian again. Well, then the next generation, there was another guy that came along, and then there was the American colonies and Thomas Paine, and looked like was going to go atheist again, and then there was the Great Awakening, and they all went back to being Christian again. So if you look at this historically, it's like they're going back and forth across the road. And some of it is simple because when you have a new generation that comes up, they're willing to try this out. And they're willing to, you know, throw everything overboard. And then once they get to the point of being in a position of responsibility, and they begin to reflect on these things, many of them come back and say, well, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea after all. So I think this is nothing really new. On occasion, there are new arguments that we haven't seen before. Like in the late 20th century, this whole what's called postmodernism now, the form of cultural relativism, that was kind of new, at least the way it was expressed was new. So the people that were that believe that there is a morality that is universal, they had some work to do on that, and those were answered. I think one of the most interesting things, though, is that one of the hardest bitten atheists, a guy named, I believe, A.J. Ayer, at the end of his life, did not become a full evangelical type of Christian, but he had, for all of his life, he had been arguing against God very successfully, at least from an academic standpoint. The end of his life, he turned around and said, the idea of God makes a whole lot of sense, and the idea of a creator God. And he didn't really necessarily become a Christian, but he gave credence to the Christian way of viewing things. So I think that we really shouldn't say, well, this is the end of the world in terms of Christian influence. I think it goes up and down, kind of like the stock market. And so if you're investing in Christian publishers, then you might want to consider which way it's going.
Okay.
But other than that, it's just the way of the world until Jesus comes, in my perspective.
Now, you having served as the executive director of the Concordia Historical Institute, can we infer from your time spent in that position that you are a historian?
That's correct. I did my, I'm a pastor is what my vocation is. But
well, I want to know if you're a pastor who's a historian or a historian who's a pastor.
I have three master's degrees in theology and church history and a Ph.D. from Union Theological Seminary, which is one of the Ivy League divinity schools in church history, and some of the most respected scholars in church history in the United States have taught there, including my doctoral advisor.
I once read a book on the Civil War, and that doesn't make me a historian. Mm-hmm. What makes a person a historian in the academic sense?
Well, there's the training of a historian, and then there's the practice of being a historian.
How do you practice being a historian?
Well, you write articles, mostly.
Ah.
And you have to do research. And ever since Leopold von Ranke, which was a German professor of history, if I remember right, he was at the University of Berlin, Ranke emphasized the importance of going to primary sources. So in other words, eyewitness sources, if you can get them. And so historians since the time of Rocky have been very, very focused on the collection of and the organization and making available primary sources. So letters would say from Martin Luther to his friend Lucas Cranach. We have one letter that's even published in English there. That is a primary source. Luther talks about his trip to Worms for the trial there and is going back. And so you take, you know, this is eyewitness. It's not like second or third hand. Here's the man that actually did it, writing to one of his best friends. So you take that as a primary source, and if you have like secondary sources that are farther removed from the action, they're of lesser, if there's a conflict, they're not as important. So one of the things that the historians do is collecting and organizing these type of primary sources, letters, diaries, articles published by people, if they're artists, you would be collecting their materials. And then the historian goes into these places called archives, and that's what Concordia Historical Institute is. It's the archive for retaining the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And you go in there and you look at these things that are, you know, in many cases they're just falling apart because they're hundreds of years old, and you translate them, and then you sometimes you publish the translations, other times you just use that as evidence and say, this is what happened, and this is as close as we can get to the action as reporting on the scene. So that's part of what historians do. That's like primary level research, and then there's secondary level research where historians say, okay, based on all this primary evidence, what type of patterns can we see here that are going on? So when I just explained here on the radio the pattern of atheism and revival of religion, that's a secondary level historical interpretation. And then there's also the work that historians do of teaching, as they do at college and high schools, and then publication too. So all those things constitute the primary work of historians. Many communities have local historians too. We have a gentleman that's a professor at University of Southern Indiana, and he's published a number of very good books on the local history of Evansville and the area. And usually there's somebody like that. It's a high school teacher or a local college professor that becomes kind of the regional expert on things historical. And that's what Concordia Historical Institute is on a national level, the same type of thing for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I don't know if you're in the habit of looking at USA Today or not, but in today's edition of USA Today, page 6A, the Nation section, there's an article here that I thought might be of some interest to you as a historian. The headline is Planned High-Tech Museum to Take Scholarly Look at Bible. The subheadline is Organizers Say History, Not Ministry, is the Aim. Kathy Lynn Grossman is the writer of the article. Out of Washington, D.C., she writes, a multi-million dollar high-tech interactive museum of the Bible is on the way after a symbolic announcement amid 130 artifacts of the Good Book in a private exhibition at the Vatican Embassy here. The exhibit was a sampler of Jewish, Roman Catholic, and Protestant treasures from the Future Museum's 10,000 manuscripts and texts, one of the world's largest biblical collections. Some were as old as pages of the Gospel in the Aramaic of Jesus' time, as political as the only Bible edition ever authorized by the U.S. Congress, and as treasured as first editions of the King James Version displayed near the King's own seal. These will form the basis for a public museum designed to engage people in the history and the impact of the Bible, says museum sponsor Steve Green, an evangelical businessman and owner of Oklahoma City-based nationwide craft chain Hobby Lobby. The Green family has amassed the world's largest collection of ancient biblical manuscripts and texts, including his favorite, the 1782 Aitken Bible, authorized by Congress. The location, architecture, and even the museum's name are still in the works, but 300 highlights of the Green Collection will go on tour beginning May 16th at the Oklahoma Museum of Art. The traveling exhibit called Passages will move to the Vatican in October and New York City by Christmas. Had you heard about this?
No, that sounds interesting. Are they going to show it in St. Louis? Because you often have venues in St. Louis for things like this.
Well, I don't see anything that suggests that that's going to be happening anytime soon. Is this something that, as both a pastor and a historian, you say to yourself something like, that is awesome, it's about time, I can't wait to visit it myself? Or are you more likely to say, uh-oh, people taking a look at the Bible through the eyes of history alone and not theologically, this can only be trouble? Which of the two do you tend to lean toward?
Well, I probably wouldn't see it either way.
A third option.
Yeah, you know, I always come up with a third option usually. Sounds to me like a good thing, and if it's if it was here in Evansville or St. Louis, I probably would make a trip out to see it. What it sounds like you're going to see is copies of the Bible, very old copies of the Bible. And when we were in seminary, part of the thing that we learn about is the transmission of the Bible, which is, you could make this, the Bible would be like a long string of characters, alphabetical characters. But originally it came in the form of, as far as we know, scrolls. And then they were copied to other scrolls, and, they kept getting copied until there was this thing called the Codex, which was a very simple type of book invented about a little bit after Jesus, or at least became used a lot after Jesus. And then the scrolls began to be, that text was put onto the codexes, and at the time of Gutenberg, then people could publish in a mass amount because of movable type. And now you have the same text, you can put it on your iPod. So what's amazing, first off, is how this same text, this long string of alphabetical characters, has been translated in all different languages, just about every language that's out there, and that it's available in so many different technologies. So what I think would be interesting for the public is not that they're going to see, oh, it's a different Bible. No, it's the same Bible in the sense of the meaning that's there. John 1:1 is still John 1:1. But how is the Bible published, and how is it used in different generations and in different countries? That's what I think will be interesting. It's more of a cultural thing that way.
And you say John 1:1 is still John 1:1. Let me read on here.
Okay.
The announcement last week was made at the Vatican Assembly to highlight the Catholic contribution to the best-loved English text, the 1611 King James Version, which draws about 80% of its majestic language from an earlier translation by a Catholic priest. Meanwhile, scholars at 30 universities worldwide are burrowing into rare texts from the collection and pioneering technology that enables them to bring out the ancient words in the most faded and printed-over manuscripts, according to Scott Carroll. He is director of the Collection and Research Professor of Manuscript Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. One of Carroll's earlier efforts to make the ancient world accessible led to a standing exhibition at the Smithsonian Institution on his online education program that enabled students in 35 countries to, quote-unquote, join in excavation of the world's oldest monastery. His primary focus has been finding and authenticating ancient manuscripts that can deepen or alter our understanding of the Word of God. The Bible didn't come from the sky as tablets handed to Moses on Mount Sinai and then wind up in a hotel desk drawer, Carroll says. The Bible is not in a lockbox. It changes across time, he says, pointing to the earliest known manuscript fragment of Genesis. And that's where I'd like to start. John 1:1 is still John 1:1, according to Pastor Nolan. But it does change across time. What does that mean? We'll ask Pastor Martin Nolan on the other side of this break. Stay with us. You're listening to the Bible Study.
Servanthood is a core value of Concordia Seminary. To be a servant is alien to so many people in our society. Even some clergy take on authoritarian airs. But Jesus, Son of God and Lord of all, came as a servant. We want Concordia graduates to model servanthood to their congregations and to their communities. Servanthood, that's the Christian way.
The Choir of St. John's College, Cambridge, comes for one performance to the Cathedral Basilica of St. Louis, April 5th at 8 p.m. There's more information at 314-533-7662 or online at cathedralconcerts.org.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
First Choice Pregnancy Services in Las Vegas is a pro-life clinic for women facing an unexpected pregnancy. They and many other centers daily deal with women who are being forced or coerced into having an abortion. The clinic counters this with a graphic, true-to-life video of what abortion's all about. Recently, a First Choice staff member overheard one of their clients tell her male companion, "I'm not having an abortion. They let me watch a video that showed what the doctor would do to my baby and my body." Many times, the shocking truth of abortion empowers women to stand up to pressure and choose life for their babies. It enables them to make a life-affirming choice that both she and her baby can live with, and no regret of abortion.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Condemnation. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. A Florida church's burning of the Koran has been denounced by President Barack Obama and General David Petraeus, but that hasn't stopped violent protests in Afghanistan that have killed at least 20 people. In a statement, Obama called desecration of the Koran an act of extreme intolerance and bigotry, but he said that didn't justify attacking and killing innocent people. General Petraeus, joined by NATO's top civilian in Afghanistan, went on the NATO channel to say,
"We condemn the action of an individual in the United States who burned a holy Koran."
NATO Ambassador Mark Sedwill added,
"This was an act of disrespect to the Muslim faith and to all peoples of faith."
The Koran was burned March 20th by the same Florida pastor who threatened to do so last September 11th. The Taliban said free speech cannot justify what it called an un-Islamic act. I'm Steve Coleman.
KFUO Radio invites you to join us for weekly Lenten worship. Every Wednesday at 11 a.m., we'll take you to Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County for a live broadcast of their Lenten worship service. Make this worship hour a part of your Lenten season. Be listening every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Live Lenten worship from KFUO. Because we are where you are, across the nation and around the world.
Concordia Publishing House.
Conflicting ideas about what marriage is and isn't may cause you to ask, what does it all mean? Marriage by God's Design from Concordia Publishing House is a complete kit that will foster meaningful discussion about the joys and challenges of married and single living. Concordia Publishing House at cph.org.
You're listening to our Ask the Pastor Hour of the Bible Study, 505-780-1800-730-2727. Our guest here today is Dr. Martin Nolan, pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, also a trained historian and former executive director of the Concordia Historical Institute here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The headline in USA Today is Planned High-Tech Museum to Take Scholarly Look at Bible. Organizers say history, not ministry, is its aim. And we were able to read the article as far as the quote here. The Bible is not in a lockbox. It changes across time. The speaker here is a guy by the name of Scott Carroll. He made this comment saying, pointing to the earliest known manuscript fragment of Genesis, a section of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a Jewish Torah from the time of the Spanish Inquisition and more. So what do you make of that quote? The Bible is not in a lockbox. It changes across time, Doctor.
The Bible as a book, as it's really a type of technology, that does change. Like I said, the Bible you now can get on your iPod or your iPhone. We had to laugh. It was over a year ago when the new iPhone products came out, and one of my elders was in the Bible class, and his wife kind of did the elbow in the ribs thing. She didn't think he was paying attention. And he kept working on what he was doing on his phone, and I realized that there was causing a disturbance. So I just kind of asked, "Well, what are you doing in there?" And he said, "Well, I'm looking up the words you just quoted from the Bible." And he says, "I can get that verse that you just quoted, plus all the other verses that connect to it." I think he was looking at cross references. I said, "You can do that on your phone?" He said, and this was about a year ago,
yeah.
And he's pretty good on this technology stuff. So here's just an example. I mean, a little cell phone now has the Bible, and you can do almost everything with it that you can do with a standard study Bible. It's just kind of amazing. So, yes, the Bible does change because the Bible it's a book. It's a technology. In fact, the Bible originally wasn't in a book. It was on scrolls. See, books are those things that we're so used to having in a library that has a cover and it has those leaves that kind of fold over. But a scroll is a different thing. A scroll is a roll-up. It's like your paper towels. That is not a book. Now, the word Biblia in Latin originally just means book. So really, the Bible wasn't in existence before those original codexes. But see, now you're playing with words, and I think that sometimes people that are promoting an exhibit like that, they'll do that. But what I'm talking about when I talk about the Bible is the text. It's the string of Hebrew characters for the Old Testament and the string of Greek characters for the New. Which are linguistic phenomena, and they have been copied faithfully, and that's what we recognize as the Bible, and that's where we get the Word of God from. That isn't changed. I mean, it has to be changed by translation, obviously. Otherwise, it would not be accessible for most of us. You know, there's a lot of pastors in our church that are pretty good in Greek, and there's a few pastors that are pretty good in Hebrew, and they can go to those original strings of characters and give you word by word exactly what those words mean. But for the rest of us, we need a translation, and that's already a type of change. But does it change the meaning? No, that's part of the gift and the challenge of translating, is to get as much of the original meaning into the translation as possible without altering it. And anybody who knows two languages will understand what I'm saying. If you only know one language, you really don't know how translation works and how successful it works if you're good.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. James, you're on the Bible study.
Yes, Pastor Nolan, can you comment a little bit on whether pluralism within Christianity is a positive movement, since it emphasizes interfaith dialogue? And what are some of the primary sources that I can access about the history of religious pluralism? And I'll hang up and listen. It's always great to hear you, Doctor.
Thanks for the call, James.
Thank you.
Pastor?
Thank you, James. It's good to talk to you again, or talk with you. Pluralism has a lot of different meanings. The type of pluralism that I think is good is where people are willing to talk to each other about their faiths, about their beliefs, without knocking them each other over the head or getting into an emotional argument, but you know, just trying to explain, this is what I believe and this is why I believe it, and then listening to the other person saying the same thing without doing that in a demeaning way. That is, that would be religious pluralism, where you have people of different religious faiths, or maybe even not a faith, but maybe they have philosophical views, and they're talking with each other. If you have a situation where people are not talking to each other, and then you really don't have pluralism. You have, it's kind of, they're all in their own little silo or ghetto, and it's not really pluralism. Pluralism is where people are willing to talk to each other, and it doesn't mean you give up your faith or you change your mind, but that you're willing to talk. So my understanding of pluralism is that this type of thing goes on. Now, there are other terms. Sociologists will talk about pluralism to mean that you have, let's say, the United States is religiously pluralistic. And that, when they look at that, they're saying it, whether or not there's any dialogue going on, they just mean that there's a bunch of different faiths. You can go to a religious atlas, and you can see, for example, the United States, a map of all the counties, and then they're color-coded by which is the dominant faith. And you can see in the west of the United States, the western half, Roman Catholicism in all those counties is the group that has the most adherents. And you go to the southeast quarter of the United States, and it's usually the Baptists. And then the rest of the country, it's kind of all mixed. So that's a sociological or maybe a civil or political type of pluralism. But the type of pluralism that I think that has been useful is where people actually talk to each other. And this is how Christians actually make converts, at least in their better way. You know, there have been Christians that have tried to convert people by force. Somebody, I think, Chuck, you mentioned the Spanish Inquisition. They didn't convert the people they put to death, but they sure converted a lot of people that were afraid of being put to death. And you could say that the people that converted were hypocritical, but they were trying to save their lives. So actually, the people that were forcing people to convert, I would say, are the ones that really were the hypocrites. They did not understand the Christian faith. Outside of those type of cases, though, a forcible conversion, most of Christian history has been where Christians have talked to the people that they encounter, and they try to understand their God. And what Christians usually do is they try to say, okay, do you believe in a God? And they say, well, yes. Well, we also believe in God. So we've got a commonality here, something we can both talk about. If they didn't believe in a God at all, it would be very difficult. They'd have to start from square one. And then they talk with those people about, what other things do we have in common? Did you believe that your God made the world? Well, we believe that too. So what you have here is a dialogue that's going on. And so really, any time that there is what Christians call mission work or evangelism or proselyting, there is a type of pluralism that's going on. The Christians may not always win the day there. They may walk away and not convert anybody. But there has been an explanation of each party's position. And that, I think, has gone on since the very beginning of Christianity. It has been among many religious faiths, Christianity has that part of it as part of its character. This is a problem with the Jewish religion before Christianity, in that it was pretty much a national religion, and they would let people come in, but there wasn't as much interest in this sort of dialogue and find out what you believe. That's my understanding of pluralism from a religious sense, and I think it needs to go on. I don't think that some people, here's the last example of pluralism. Some people say pluralism is when I have my faith and you have your faith, and we're both right. Well, that's not really pluralism anymore. That's relativism. You've given up your position of saying this is really true. So that, and often people today will use that last example as what they really are looking for.
Let me ask you one more question here on this subject here, and then I'd like to take up the Quran burning story here before we run out of time. And that is, let us say that somehow, some way, maybe an moving exhibit or something comes close to Evansville, Indiana, and you have an opportunity not only to visit this high-tech museum as it's described here. And by the way, the end of the article says that Green and Carroll say their museum opening in 2016 has no theological agenda.
Right.
Here's a quote. Think of the great new science museums that take you inside how things work, or the Folgers Library's public and scholarly center for Shakespeare, Carroll says. This will be our approach to the Bible. It's a museum, not a ministry. Let's say that you have an opportunity to visit this. What do you have to see there, or what do you have to not see, in order to say to, the local Lutheran school teacher, take the kids to the museum, it'll be great?
Well, I don't think I need to really to preface this. I mean, it will be great because what... It's a problem with a lot of our people in the United States in that we don't have a lot of anything really old around us. Our downtown areas have been totally remade. In St. Louis you do have a few old things there. You have the old cathedral. But unless you go into a museum...
When you say old, you mean old.
Yeah, I mean old. I mean a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go, let's say, to Europe... You go, and everywhere you go, every town has got, especially the bigger cities, has a downtown area with buildings that are sometimes 1,000 years old. And then you look at that building and say, wow, I mean, it was really here. You know, so the story about Martin Luther, which would be 500 years ago, or about Charlemagne. My wife and I were in Aachen, Germany, and it's the castle there of Charlemagne, which goes back to 800 AD. And then you can go to places in the Middle East like the pyramids, and those things go back, 5,000 years. And so here in the United States, we don't have a good sense of a long period of history, maybe the last 100 years, but maybe not much before that. And so for us to get a sense of history and how real those, and how different history is from the movies, which are usually almost all fictional, or from books, the whole fiction section of the library. The history is something that actually happened, and a lot of those things have made us who we are. Going to an exhibit like this is something that helps. It helps your brain grasp the fact that these things are real, and the thing about Christianity is that it's a historical religion. It's not based on myth. And so that the people there that are reported about in the Old and New Testament, they were real people, and they saw these things, and they're reporting on them. And that is, I think it's helpful to the faith to see things related to our Christian faith that are of this historical nature. So, yeah, if it's coming into my area, I'm going to go there and encourage our school groups to go, too.
All right, let's take a look at this story from Jalalabad, Afghanistan. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. This story from the Associated Press says, a Florida church's burning of the Quran has been denounced by President Barack Obama and General David Petraeus, but that has not stopped violent protests in Afghanistan that have killed at least 20 people, including 7 UN employees. In a statement, Obama called desecration of the Quran, quote, an act of extreme intolerance and bigotry, unquote. But he said that didn't justify attacking and killing innocent people. General Petraeus, joined Sunday by NATO's top civilian in Afghanistan, said, quote, we condemn in particular the action of an individual in the United States who recently burned the Holy Quran, unquote. The book was burned March 20th by the same Florida pastor who had threatened to do so last September 11th. The Taliban said in a statement that free speech cannot justify what it called an un- Islamic act. So I'm trying to sort this out, Pastor, because as I'm sure you're well aware, there have been those in the United States who have taken it upon themselves to desecrate Christian symbols in some really disgusting, vile, and vulgar ways. And as far as the government of the United States is concerned, there hasn't been too much pushback from that. But all of a sudden, our government seems to be quite concerned about this Florida pastor burning the Quran. Can you sort this out for me?
Well, the I know that the United States has laws about free speech. And I think that used to be understood in one way, and I think since the 1960s, when they had all this flag burning because of the Vietnam War, then it began. I think that the definition of what was free speech and protected by free speech was changed. I could be wrong. You have to talk to some lawyer that understands all this. But I mean, I don't think that the original Constitution, and it's talking about free speech, would protect something like this. Actually, free speech originally in the English Constitution or the English government was intended to protect the right of senators and legislatures to make their arguments without having to be worried about getting knocked off by the king or by their opponents. So it's originally a legislative freedom, not something that just happens to anybody. We do have things in the United States that are called hate crimes, and they're crimes that are done with the intent of provocation, with provoking people to commit other crimes. And I would think that this gentleman, it's not just a book. For the Islamic people, the Quran represents their religion. And for Christians, too, the Bible does in a similar way. And to do this in a political way, I would think that it should be considered a hate crime, and it should have the proper penalties for that. But I'm not a lawyer, so I can't answer whether that's, you know, the right way to do it. It's certainly not a Christian thing to do.
Well, it
in
seems,
any way.
It seems to me, and I'm trying to think this through, I do not support the Florida pastor and his burning of the Quran. My sensitivities, my sensibilities tell me that it is an inappropriate, unhelpful, and at least disrespectful thing to do. It is not commendable, and I think it's a condemnable act. So there I am. I am on the record. But there are quite a number of other things that I thought also fit that category, that when it was done regarding the Christian faith or the Christian religion, what we heard was, well, I know, but freedom of speech. And so it more or less was allowed to stand. Until now. It seems like an inconsistency to me. So I'm not here, I don't want anybody to say, well, Chuck supports the Florida pastor. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I don't understand why it seems that you can put a crucifix in a jar of urine, for example, and that's all free speech. But what this Florida pastor did, we can say, well, that, you know, that was not a good move, but it's free speech. I guess we can't say that. I don't get it.
Yeah, well, that's politics, you know. I do not believe that the what they did with the cross and whatever that was, that really was a type of hate crime, too, against believing Christians who... Well,
apparently not.
But, I mean, it really should be considered that. I mean, the whole business about burning the flag, is that a right thing to do or not? I mean, I'm not saying the person should go to jail, but you probably should find them a pretty penny. You know, I think that's an appropriate punishment. Because what happens is people will say, oh, you can't do that because, you know, you're just burning piece of cloth. Well, you're not just burning cloth when you burn the flag. You're attacking a symbol. You're attacking the symbol of the United States. And if it's done by a Canadian, you know, they think, well, what are you trying to say? You are doing something by making the statement. And so when this Terry Jones burns a Quran, he is presumably a Christian minister, what is he trying to say? What he's doing is he's taking up the Christian mantle and saying, this is what Christians are. And I'm saying, no, Christians are not like that. We do not attack people's religions. We disagree with them, but we do not attack them. And that takes us right back to the Middle Ages and the Spanish Inquisition.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Just a few minutes remain here. Hi, Jan, you're on the Bible study.
Hi, Chuck. Hi, Pastor.
Hello.
Two things. Didn't Jesus say Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever? I'm thinking that the Bible is God's inerrant word, whether it's on parchment or on my computer. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I remember saying a while back that the church should be self-correcting. And I think the difference between burning someone's holy book or desecrating the holy book is a question of works righteousness. If I feel like I'm compelled to defend this material document, then I may act violently with my citizens, whereas Christians push back by saying, we honor God's holy word, and it's not going to change when you desecrate our importance.
Okay. We got 2 minutes here. Let's see what the pastor has to say.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Jan.
Yeah, so thank you, Janet. First off, I agree 100% that the Bible is God's inerrant word, and it doesn't matter whether it's on the iPod or a scroll or a book. That's just the way it is. And our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has gone on a record as affirming that, and we went through some pretty tough times just to continue to say that. You have an interesting idea here, though, and I think I kind of agree. I'm not sure all the implications of it, but I think what you're saying is that because Christians, our faith is not in an object, that in fact we have faith in the promises of God, which are given to us. They're translated or transmitted to us by the Bible, but we don't actually venerate an object per se. At least Protestants do not. That destruction of our objects is not a big deal. And I agree with that. So, you know, if people often ask me, well, what should I do with this hymnal? And I said, well, it's falling apart. You should throw it away. They say, but it's a holy hymnal. I said, well, it's not a Bible, but we use it in church every day. You know, but I don't know. That's not really a Protestant way of looking at things. We don't bless things, except for people, because people are Christians are the dwelling place of the Holy Spirit. But things themselves are not. The Bible is to be respected because it gives to us the Word of God. But when it falls apart, you have to throw it away. What else are you going to do with it? But the thing is, we have to understand, for other people, though, other religions do have the sense that objects have holiness connected to them. Some of the Roman Catholic people, and certainly the older Roman Catholic view, has this, the idea of a relic. Is that a bone has some of the holiness of the saint that used to own that bone, or that the bone was part of him. So for the for Islamic people, I believe, I could be wrong, but I think that the Quran has some of this type of devotional aspect to it, and you have to respect that. I mean, what would happen if people would go into the cathedral in St. Louis and, you know, take out the bones that are in the relics there? I mean, the bishop and all the faithful would just rise up in anger, because that's the holy thing for them. So we have to respect that. There's no way that you can say that this action of Terry Jones is loving your neighbor as yourself, which is the highest command we have in dealing with our neighbors. So you have to understand what they respect, and then respect that too, as long as it doesn't come into conflict or cause damage. damage to other people. So this thing is totally inexcusable that Reverend Jones did. I hope something happens that the government puts a clamp on this, because it's just wrong.
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you very much.
Good to talk to you again.
Anytime.
All righty. That is Dr. Martin Nolan here on our Ask the Pastor Hour of the Bible Study from Trinity, Evansville. Tomorrow, Pastor Kurt Taylor in 1 Peter chapter 1.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.